From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a former Pentagon and CIA official on President Trump's foreign policies.
All of this type of thing coming from the commander-in-chief emboldens the very organizations that meddled in our elections in 2016.
The anti-gerrymandering ballot proposal goes to the Michigan Supreme Court.
They say, look, we've had hundreds of thousands of people sign this petition. They want it to be on the ballot.
A quiet change in mission and policies of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Seems to me that they're just trying to even make legal immigration difficult for families and for businesses.
And ferries across the Detroit River.
So it was canoe with an engine, and a big board across the two of them.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump continues to defy the fallout from his trip to Europe and his Helsinki summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Asked this morning if Russia is still targeting the U.S., Trump mouthed the word no, and then he declared there has been no president ever as tough on Russia as he. This comes less than a week after Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats declared the cyber attack threats on our country are at a critical point. Let's get the intelligence community's view of this whipsawing. Alyssa Slotkin is a Democrat running for the 8th District Congressional seat, the one currently held by Congressman Mike Bishop. She's held top positions at the Pentagon, including the Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under the Obama administration. She was also a CIA officer serving three tours of duty in Iraq. Alyssa Slotkin, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So from your years of working in national security and defense, and you played a role in the U.S.-Russia defense relationship, what are you thinking about what you've seen and heard from the president yesterday, would versus wouldn't, and then this morning's tweet storm that seems to walk back the walk back? What do you make of this?
I think, first of all, you know, the past couple of days started off with me just kind of being in disbelief that I would ever see, as a former CIA officer, former Pentagon official, that I would ever see the commander-in-chief preferencing Vladimir Putin and the Russian intelligence services over his own. I did not think I would see that in my lifetime. So that was pretty shocking, and certainly friends who are still inside the community were just kind of shaking their heads. It felt like a new low for folks who have been already pretty under attack under this administration. I think what concerns me more than the rhetoric is how all of this type of thing coming from the commander-in-chief emboldens the very organizations that meddled in our elections in 2016. It basically says, hey, you know what? We can get away with this. We don't have a commander-in-chief who's going to push back on us, you know, who's going to sanction us, who's going to call, you know, to action his law enforcement community. And that emboldens the very organizations we are hoping to mitigate for the 2018 election.
And then today, Russia said it's ready to act on military agreements reached in that private meeting between Trump and Putin. So 2 hours together, no note takers, no chief of staff, no national security advisor. And so far, no confirmation of any agreements from the White House, the National Security Council, or the Pentagon. What do you think of that?
The Russians have, for a very, very long time, long before President Trump, have been wanting to appear as peers to the United States. They are constantly asking us to do joint military operations, joint military cells, intelligence cells. When I was working on the U.S.-Russia flight safety agreements that we had over Syria so that our pilots didn't, you know, hit into each other, we had constant asks by the Russians to do a joint cell, to come together in the same location and work together. And that's because they want to appear as our equal, equal to our military. And that's also because it's a very juicy opportunity to acquire intelligence about how we operate, about how we do our business. And we were always extremely, extremely suspicious of any request like that. So when I heard after the press conference that there had been some proposal of sort of a joint look at the meddling that had been done, it was like a big red light went off for me. This is the total Russian playbook. And the words out of the Kremlin today that they're ready to act on these things is very, very concerning.
And then coupled with what happened at the NATO meeting, slamming Germany, slamming Angela Merkel, slamming Theresa May, calling the EU nations our foes, how does that fit into all of this, in your view?
I think there's sort of the rhetorical piece, which is just breaks with 60 years of tradition, both Republican and Democratic administrations, of working closely with our allies and valuing what they bring to the table. I'm realizing that we need good neighbors, we need good friends to act in the way that we want to act in the global economy, in the world. But then it's the implications. You know, when you poke folks in the eye, it makes it very hard when you go to ask for their help, for them to turn to their public and say, hey, you know, the United States is asking for additional support in Afghanistan, or they're asking for additional support on counterterrorism operations. You know, you've just insulted their leader. How willing do you think their public and their governments are going to be to say yes when we need them?
And as a former member of the intelligence community, how do you see these words and actions from the commander-in-chief impacting those who are responsible for our national security?
The intelligence community, the FBI, the Department of Justice have been under attack from him pretty much from the beginning. A lot of them are very brave Americans. They're working abroad to collect intelligence. They're working at home to stop criminals. And I think they get up every day and they know that their job, as they swore to do in their oath, is to protect and defend the Constitution. And that's what they're doing.
How do you believe Congress can and should respond to the president's behavior toward our allies and our adversaries like Russia and North Korea and our NATO allies?
First of all, our system was designed as one of checks and balances. So the Congress should be acting as a check and balance on the president, right? It's very natural. First of all, they need to speak out. And I think, you know, the press conference a few days ago is the clearest example I've seen in a long time where really we need to be able to think about our country over our party. We need to be able to call a spade no matter who we are. And I was very happy to see a number of Republicans come out strongly and criticize the president and say that was a mistake and should be repaired. So they have a responsibility rhetorically, but then they also have a responsibility to make sure that there's plans in place to punish people who continue to meddle in our elections. Right. And I'm glad to see that there is some conversation of potential sanctions against organizations and individuals who meddle with our elections. I don't think we need to wait until 2018, you know, in case they do it again. I think Congress could be acting now. I can't think of a more serious threat to us, and it should be treated accordingly in legislation.
Going back to Helsinki, there is a school of thought, and certainly being voiced by many in Congress, Republicans in Congress, we should talk with rival nations. The talking is a way to make progress and settle differences. And the question is asked, isn't it a good thing that the president is trying to dialogue with our adversaries like North Korea and Russia?
Yes. Oh, I'm the first to say we need to keep dialogue open. But we don't engage for engagement's sake. We engage to advance the issues of mutual concern. And by my account, we haven't really seen, you know, much proof in the pudding on what came out of this summit with Putin and what came out of the summit with the North Koreans. I hope that's on a positive trajectory. But in terms of brass tacks, real stuff that got decided and acted upon, we haven't seen that yet. And that's important.
Alyssa Slotkin, former CIA officer and a former acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under President Obama. She is a Democrat running for the 8th Congressional District seat in Michigan. Alyssa, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In an effort to hear from a member of Congress, we reached out to Congressman Mike Bishop of the 8th District. His office tried but was not able to make him available for an interview today. He has released the following statement, and I quote, "Open diplomatic communication between nuclear superpowers is essential in for the safety and the security of the world. Lest anyone think otherwise, however, Vladimir Putin's Russia is not a trusted friend of the United States. The House Committee on Intelligence, along with our American intelligence community, have demonstrated Russia's efforts in undermining democracy here in the United States and across the world. We must hold Russia accountable." The Michigan Supreme Court today heard arguments on the redistricting proposal, viewed as one of the most important cases before this court. The court will decide whether the initiative goes on the November ballot. If it does make it to the ballot, and if voters approve it, Michigan would no longer have the party in power drawing up legislative districts. That power would go to a redistricting committee made up of Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Michigan Radio's Shana Roth was at court this morning for the arguments. So, Shana, on one side, we have the group Voters Not Politicians. What's their argument in favor of this anti-gerrymandering proposal?
Well, their argument is basically like, look, we followed all the rules. They say that their proposal is properly drawn out. Yes, they admit that it is very comprehensive and quite lengthy. However, they say that that shouldn't mean that it shouldn't be on the ballot proposal. And they say, look, we've had hundreds of thousands of people sign this petition. They want it to be on the ballot. We went through all of the hoops we had to with the State Board of Elections, got it approved as to form. And quite frankly, the Court of Appeals said, hey, this other side, their argument is without merit. So they're saying that we've done everything that we need to do. We've answered all of your questions. It should go on the ballot.
And on the other side, we have the group Citizens Protecting Michigan's Constitution. And they got a helping hand from the Office of Michigan's Attorney General?
Yes, the state solicitor general did argue essentially for the attorney general's office. He got a few minutes to make his argument, and he actually got some pushback from some of the Democratic justices on the panel. And what they were concerned with is, you know, don't you think people should have a voice and that that voice should be heard and they should have a chance to vote on this? But what the solicitor general and the Citizens Protecting Michigan's Constitution, what their main argument is essentially, this is too much for a ballot proposal. This is not the way that you are supposed to put these things together, that it's changing too much to the Constitution. It's changing how the powers are distributed in the state. And they said that really, if this is something that this group wants to do, what they should do is a constitutional convention.
And what did we hear from the justices with that?
It was a kind of an interesting interplay. Justice Bernstein, at one point when this idea of, well, the people should just do a constitutional convention, he said essentially, well, let's get real here. How are people actually going to call a constitutional convention? And the Solicitor General basically said, look, it would be hard to do, but the point that it's hard to do is because they're creating a new part of the Constitution.
Now, this group opposing the plan lost before the state appeals court, which landed everybody in before the Supreme Court today. Did they alter their argument at all from what they lost in June?
I mean, they got the attorney general's office on board, and I think that's kind of where more of this constitutional convention argument is coming in. But really, the crux of it, that this is too much for the proposal, has remained the same.
So do we have any idea when the justices will make their ruling?
We don't. They tend to be very quiet about that. At one point, though, a representative for the Secretary of State's office, who is technically a party to this, but they haven't really given any input. They asked the court to decide the case by early August, and that's because the final November ballot has to be certified by September 7th, and they need time to go through all of the additional things that they need to do to get this on the ballot. So hopefully we'll hear a decision by early August.
Michigan Radio's Lansing reporter, Shana Roth. Shana, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and you know what that means. It's time to talk our state's history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
With groundbreaking this week on the Gordie Howe International Bridge between Windsor and Detroit, we felt it was the perfect time to mark the 80th anniversary of the last passenger ferry to cross the Detroit River. With me now is Detroit historian and blogger Mickey Lyons. Welcome, Mickey.
Thank you.
And we're happy to say hello again to State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Hey, Mark.
Hello.
So it seems quite obvious that Native Americans living around the Straits of Detroit probably took a canoe back and forth without really a lot of thought of bureaucratic hassle. But then French colonists arrived and there was probably some enterprising person who thought, hey, wait a minute, I can make some money taking people across the river. Mark, do we have any idea when passenger ferry started? Was there a quote-unquote Jacques River Express?
We do have some good clues. I think it's really fascinating, though, that Cadillac had at least 15 bargemen with him in Detroit as of 1705. Now, those weren't ferrymen, but I just thought it was really fascinating that there were at least 15 people with the title bargeman in 1705 in Detroit. The first mention of a ferry service I could find in a written account was on the Windsor side, and parenthetically, Windsor sometimes is translated loosely as the place of the ferry. which I didn't know, which is sort of interesting. There are two written accounts of a regular ferry service offered as of 1829. Let's put air quotes around ferry. One was from Pierre Saint-Amour, and his ferry was dubbed Log Canoe Number 1. And the other was by Francois Labelaine, not surprisingly, ran Log Canoe Number 2.
Well, that was very practical.
Yeah. And Mrs. Labelaine is noted in this text as having a unique method of letting Francois know when passengers were waiting for him. She had tied a large 4-foot tin horn to her door, and she blew it whenever passengers arrived and he was needed to transport them.
I love it. Mickey, follow this for a minute. Detroit goes from French control to British control to American control, back to the British, and then finally back to American control after the War of 1812. So is this when we really see the start of the golden era of Detroit-Windsor ferry service?
I would say definitely. I mean, it's been pretty strong, as we mentioned, since the very beginning. The borders between the U.S. and Canada, or Detroit and Windsor, have always been a lot more porous than they are now. But I would say post-1812, the 1830s, with the opening of the Erie Canal system as well, all of a sudden we have this opportunity for people to make money getting folks back and forth. The very first steam ferry that existed here was just a few years after the first steamboat in the Great Lakes. It was the Argo, and that was in 1830. So it was a steam ferry, but it was really, they had two steam engines across from each other that floated on the water that were strapped to canoes. So it was essentially like a catamaran.
It
was canoe with an engine, and a big board across the two of them. That was the first commercial steam ferry in Detroit, yeah.
And before that, Mark, we were looking at paddle, and did we ever use wind?
Well, I didn't find an account of wind. It's not a great option when you're doing straight-line ferry service. It's just not dependable, so it doesn't mean somebody didn't try it. I just didn't find a written account of it. But so paddle, and then, as Mickey said, steam became the reliable source.
And Mickey, as the years progressed, the Walkerville Ferry started operating in the 1880s. And then by the 1920s, those ferries were moving a little more than passengers, weren't they?
Oh, they were. They definitely moved plenty of passengers. It became imperative for Detroit drinkers to head over to Windsor for the afternoon or evening after Prohibition started in 1918 in Michigan. So the Walkerville Ferry became incredibly popular and incredibly important. 1928, during the height of Prohibition, just before the Depression started, the ferry ran 24 hours a day over the 4th of July weekend for 4 straight days. In 1929, it took over 100,000 passengers in one day. So, I mean, extremely popular, and a lot of folks came back a little bit heavier than they left.
So, Mark, just a few years after Prohibition came to an end, on this date in 1938, the last passenger ferry ran between Windsor and Detroit. So how did people mark the occasion, and what caused the demise of the passenger ferries on the Detroit River?
Well, the newspapers reported that an estimated 30,000 passengers crowded on to get one last ride on the Windsor Ferry's last day of operation. So they marked it by trying to get one last ride on one of the two ferries running that route, the LaSalle and the Cadillac. As far as the demise of the operations, you can probably attribute it to two things in general: the opening of the Ambassador Bridge in 1929, and then the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel in 1930 that really cut into that ferry service and didn't really make it a viable option going forward. I think, and while this is the last date for that particular ferry service, there's all sorts of asterisks that people will probably be raising their hand right now as we speak, saying, wait, was the Walkerville ferry that ran till 42, and there was the Belle Isle and later the Boblo, and then also we still have ferry service going to Harson's Island. So
okay, be still my heart. Don't even say Boblo. Our hearts are also broken over the St. Clair.
I know.
Oh, so many happy memories if you grew up in Detroit. That's a whole nother topic. Mickey, do you ever see a chance a passenger ferry service could return in the 21st century?
I would love to see that. It's complicated, I would say, because we are such a large international border is really the problem. As Mark was saying, the bridge and the tunnel sort of spelled the demise of the transportation by boat across the river. I find it kind of ironic that in 1930, with the opening of the Windsor Tunnel, the Detroit and Walkerville Ferry Company took out a newspaper ad congratulating them.
Oops.
I know. In retrospect. But yeah, I mean, I would say it's tough because of customs, because of Homeland Security. It can be difficult. And also, you know, it's a large commercial and navigational channel. So there's a lot of boats that go up and down that channel. So getting something across regularly might be a little trickier than we think.
But I bet people listening, hands up, who would not love to see a way, if you're on a bicycle,
yes,
or you're a pedestrian, to be able to go back and forth between Detroit and Windsor and do it that easily? Maybe not in the wintertime, but boy, I could see that as a really rich addition to our warm weather offerings on the river.
It works for Mackinac Island. I mean, who doesn't like taking the ferry over to the island? I realize it's not an apples to apples comparison, but we are Michiganders. We love water. Why not?
And with bicycling such a big deal, that would be such an easy way to be able to make that happen, which it's not right now.
Yeah. It's been something we've been thinking about for a while, too. In the 80s, I think the late 80s, the city planner of Detroit suggested it and said, I want this to happen. I want there to be a 3 times a day ferry from the United States over to Windsor. And it just, for the same reasons, just never quite happened.
Well, and I don't think you can look at the tunnel bus as sort of the bellwether of whether it would work or not, because clearly that's a different experience.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Clearly, indeed. Well, it's something to keep our eye on, and perhaps some entrepreneurial spirit is listening to us talk right now, and we're planting the seeds of an idea. Detroit historian and blogger Mickey Lyons and state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Thanks to both of you for helping us mark this 80th anniversary of the last passenger ferry to traverse the Straits of Detroit officially. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As the nation's attention has been focused on the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy and family separations at our southern border, another immigration agency has quietly made changes in its mission and policies that could threaten immigrants who are here legally. Recent changes by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services could endanger just about any immigrant looking for a change in benefits. Bushra Malik is an immigration attorney with Butzel Long's office in Bloomfield Hills. Bushra, people know about ICE, they know about the Customs and Border Patrol, but tell us about the role United States Citizenship and Immigration Services traditionally plays in the immigration system.
Well, traditionally, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, commonly known as USCIS, has been the branch tasked with providing benefits and services to immigrants to the United States. But over the past year, that has changed, and you know, USCIS has become more enforcement-minded.
And to that point, the agency recently changed its mission statement, and that change certainly focuses a shift in philosophy. Tell us the differences between the old and the new mission statement.
So the old mission statement stated that the USCIS secured America's promise as a nation of immigrants by providing accurate and useful information to its customers, granting citizenship benefits, promoting awareness of citizenship, and ensuring the integrity of the immigration system.
And the new statement?
The new statement states that USCIS administers the nation's lawful immigration system, safeguarding its integrity, promoting efficiency, adjudicating requests for immigration benefits, while protecting Americans and securing the homeland and honoring our values. So what's taken out there is that the language of that America is a nation of immigrants. That language is no longer in the mission statement.
And securing the homeland is new in that mission statement, too. So there's a sea change, is there not, in the direction of this agency?
Yes, absolutely.
And then to add to that, I want to talk about two memos that have come out. We're going to go one by one. The first memo, issued in late June, effective immediately, did what?
The new memo, effective late June 28, 2018, outlines how USCIS can now issue notices to appear by mail once applicants make applications by mail.
All right, explain what that means.
A notice to appear, commonly known also as an NTA, puts the person into deportation or removal proceedings. This has never happened before, where somebody who's applying for immigration benefits via mail to a service center would receive an NTA in the mail.
And what kind of complications does that present for someone who is looking to renew their work or their student visas?
For example, if somebody's in H-1B status and they apply for an extension, if ultimately that extension was denied, the person could then appeal it or make a decision to go back home. Now, if a person is issued a notice to appear, they're put into removal proceedings, and they have to stay in the United States until their deportation case is heard. They can't just depart the country voluntarily and go back to their home country.
So, and proceeding with the deportation hearing, am I right that it would basically, if it goes through and they're deported, that slams the door on any option of ever coming back?
Well, actually, there's two things that'll happen.
Okay.
One thing is that, well, if you fail to appear for your deportation hearing, there's a 5-year bar on you. So people are required to stay for the deportation hearing. So that's one. The second thing is, once individuals stay in the United States, remember at this point their case has been denied. So they're accruing unlawful presence in the United States. And if you accrue unlawful presence for more than 1 year in the United States, you're barred for reentering for 10 years. In deportation proceedings are being booked right now in the immigration court several years out because they're so backed up. So in effect, these are individuals who will be subject to 10-year bars because they're probably going to have to wait certainly for more than a year at least to have their deportation case heard.
So it's kind of catch-22.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Since this memo's come out and this immediate change in policy, Bushra, what are you hearing from clients who are in the process of renewing work visas or seeking green cards?
Okay, so the practical impact is if an individual is trying to renew their work permit, and if the work permit isn't issued before their current status expires, because immigration is very backed up. Normally, an H-1B extension would take 3 to 6 months, and sometimes now we're seeing like 6 to 10 months for an H-1B extension. If their case was, in fact, denied, they would be issued a notice to appear and put in deportation proceedings, instead of just being told their case is denied and you can go home or appeal this. That's the change.
Why would the government issue denials? What kind of reasons are being given?
Well, previously, extensions for work permits, H-1Bs, L-1s, would be approved without much issue if nothing in the role had changed. But last fall, a memo came out from USCIS that stated that previous approvals should not be looked at with deference, that each case should be tried anew, whereas previously getting an extension was pretty easy if nothing had changed. That has changed now.
All right. And the second memo that was released late last week on July 13th, and it's effective September 1st, what does this memo outline?
This memo states that if a case is submitted, an application or a petition, USCIS can now deny those applications if information is missing without issuing a request for additional information or a notice of intent to deny. Previously, USCIS, if they received an application or petition that was missing some information, they would issue a request for evidence requesting more information.
These actions certainly seem to reflect the shift in immigration policies from the Trump administration. But we're not talking about people walking across the border seeking asylum. We're talking about the professional class. They're here legally. How do you see these memos and this change in direction fitting in with the Trump immigration policy?
Well, it seems to me that they're just trying to even make legal immigration difficult for families and for businesses. You're right. I agree. It's not the people who are crossing into the United States illegally. These are people who are trying to follow the proper immigration system and do everything legally. But it seems that the Trump administration is making that even more and more difficult as well.
Even as the president had said, follow the rules. And you're saying people that did follow the rules, did everything, are kind of being maybe locked into something that could see them sent home.
Absolutely. And these two memos play into each other. There is a relationship between them. The second memo that was released last Friday states that a request for evidence or notice of intent to deny will not be issued and cases will just be denied by USCIS if information is missing, relates to the initial memo that states that notice to appear can be issued if a case is denied. So, for example, if someone has an H-1B extension pending and their case is denied because some information was missing, that person could be put into removal proceedings. So the two memos are actually related.
And what are you seeing in your practice? Are you seeing the effects of this at this point?
No, but we are going to be start advising our clients to file applications as soon as possible. so that they can continually stay in status. And also, we will also be advising them to get U.S. permanent residence if possible. We'll also be advising them to file everything premium processing. Premium processing is an extra fee you can pay to USCIS to process your case in 15 calendar days, and you have to pay an extra $1,225 to do that.
It's a lot of money for people.
It is, but 15 calendar days in comparison to getting an H-1B extension done in like 6 to 8 months. People can't afford to wait for that long, and also because of these memos, can't afford to possibly put into deportation proceedings. So they're going to have to pay that $1,225 to get decisions in a timely manner.
Busher, are you seeing people thinking maybe Canada's looking better than trying their luck with the changing climate in the United States?
Absolutely. I've had clients change their immigration routes from the United States to Canada or Australia. In particular, students these days, students from India and China who have 10-year backlogs to get a green card, they would much rather go to Canada and get, you know, permanent resident status there, probably in less than a year compared to our 10 years. So we are losing, sometimes we are losing the best and the brightest, as they say, because these are, you know, people who are getting master's degrees and PhDs in the United States, but thereafter, they'd rather go to Canada, Australia, or sometimes even back to their home countries.
Bushra Malik, immigration attorney with Butzel Long in Bloomfield Hills. Thank you so much for talking to us about the changes in the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Thank you.
Coming up, we begin round two of interviews with the candidates for governor. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With the Michigan primary closing in, Stateside is inviting the gubernatorial candidates back for one last chance to speak to you. Today, we welcome back Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. The 33-year-old is the former director of the Detroit Health Department. It's good to have you back, doctor.
Thanks for having me, Cindy. I'm really excited to be here.
And I want to start with a question that I actually asked you when you sat down here for the first time, May of 2017, which kind of made my eyes pop. It's hard to believe.
It's a long campaign.
I'll tell you. So if you win, you would be the youngest U.S. governor since Bill Clinton was elected in 1978 as governor of Arkansas, and you would be America's first Muslim governor. What do you say to voters with misgivings about either your age or your religion, particularly in a state that voted for Donald Trump?
This is about a vision for Michigan. It's about whether or not we want to do the work of taking back our politics, talking about a Michigan where we're not beholden to big corporations, and instead we together decide that we're willing to do the work of fixing basic problems, making sure every Michigander has health care, standing up to people like Betsy DeVos who have ruined our public schools, making sure that the auto insurance rates aren't so ridiculously expensive. And I believe that we should be empowered toward that kind of politics with leaders who are willing to speak truth to power and are willing to listen, to learn, and to reflect in real, in-depth policy solutions. And we've offered that. I think youth is as much a credit as anything else. It's the willingness to have the energy, have the enthusiasm, have the perspective. And I know that I, as a young person, speak for the largest generation in Michigan right now, which is the millennial generation, and about the kind of future we want to raise our kids in. And as a Muslim American and Arab American, I've always said that my responsibility is to every Michigander. And I believe that having been raised in a multicultural household where my father was an Egyptian immigrant, and my stepmother who raised me, born and raised in Gratiot County, Michigan, that I bring the perspective that many in Michigan have, bringing those perspectives together and recognizing that it's important to listen, learn, and draw those similarities, bringing us back to that common humanity that we share. And so I believe that both of those things are real strengths.
Your background in public health has certainly been the foundation of your campaign. And to that point, you've recently released your energy plan, a three-part plan with the goal of what exactly?
So we know that one of the biggest challenges that we face in the state right now is that we've allowed these big corporations to pollute our air and our water. And we've got a responsibility to stand up. That means, number one, the Department of Environmental Quality, which is supposed to be the regulator that is supposed to stand up to these corporations, it needs to have both the capacity and the teeth to do that. And it's preempted from doing that right now. In the past, the DEQ used to have a budget in the hundreds of millions. Today, it's 27 million, and they don't have the means to actually do the work they need. We're proposing that we would bring together the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environmental Quality under one Department of the Environment. We would raise their budget to nearly $1 billion, empowering them with the capacity to investigate and to regulate so that we are protected in our air and water. Second, we know that there are large corporations who get away polluting air and water because we haven't stood up and forced them to bear the cost of doing that. And we're proposing a corporate polluter fee that would force them to pay per gigaton of carbon output and emissions that pollute our air. And then that money would be returned directly to everyday folks in the form of a taxpayer stipend. This is the best way to disincentivize that kind of pollution and to empower people so that they are actually being paid the costs of the pollution that they're forced to breathe every day. And then lastly, we need to be able to invest in renewable energy infrastructure. We don't have the means of doing that. And we proposed a program called the Pure Michigan Infrastructure Bank. And what it would do is it would finance investments in renewable energy infrastructure, things like wind turbines and things like solar panels to be able to harvest renewable energy, and then also the means to store it in batteries. And then over time, we would push legislation to allow net metering or to extend net metering, which is current policy, but it is sunsetting. And net metering basically says that if you are harvesting and holding renewable energy, that you can sell that energy back into the grid. So instead of you having to pay DTE, DTE has to pay you. All of this is about pushing Michigan forward to a renewable energy future, and we're intending to get there by 2030, 100% renewable energy.
So how would you, if elected governor, work with what could be still a GOP-controlled legislature to wean Michigan off fossil fuels?
Well, look, I believe in the ability to inspire and the ability to find shared wins, and if not, the ability to make it challenging for folks to do things that are not in the best interest of all of us. The facts of our system is that we are a democracy and the power is vested in people. And so we've got to rely on people to speak to their representatives. As an elected governor, I am just one person of many folks elected to do the people's bidding. And my appeal will be right to the people who elected legislators. And so I'm interested in traveling the state, as I have done. We've been to 125 cities across the state, and having conversations with Michiganders and their representatives about what it means to stand up for 100% renewable energy, what it means to stand up for universal health care, what it means to stand up for public schools that are high quality and well invested in. And I know that making that appeal right to Michiganders is going to be the most successful way of working with the legislature. Now, I look forward to working across the aisle with anybody who's got Michigan's best interest at heart. And I know that I can do that. I've rebuilt the health department in the poorest city in America in post-bankruptcy Detroit. And it wasn't always easy hoeing, but I do know that if you're willing to sit down with somebody and you're willing to find common ground, there's a lot more work that's there to do together if you're willing to have that humility and have that conversation. I look forward to that.
Dr. El-Sayed, you've been endorsed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose upset defeat of New York Congressman Joseph Crowley made some big national headlines. And I know she's coming to Michigan to campaign with you. Why?
We're really excited because I think she's shown us how it's done. Our movement is about people coming together for a politics as it was supposed to be, to build a government for the people and by the people. I don't take a dime of corporate money. Instead, we're reaching out to folks that most Democrats even and Republicans have forgotten, people who they say, well, it's not worth having a conversation with them because they don't vote. Mm-hmm. Fact is, they haven't had anything to vote for. And if you are honest about your message, you are willing to stand up to the corporations that have corrupted our politics, and you're willing to speak truth to power, what you'll find is that folks will come and say, you know what, I want to vote for you for the first time. Every day I walk through the state of Michigan, somebody comes up to me and says, you know what, I've never been registered to vote, and I've registered specifically to vote for you, and I hope that you'll keep on with your message. Alexandra showed us how that's done, and I'm really proud of the work that she's put in. I'm very thankful for her support, and I'm excited to share both her with the people of Michigan and the people of Michigan, more importantly, with her. I think there's a lot we can learn. And people forget sometimes that this state went for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primary. We are a progressive state. And
so you're not worried she's perhaps too far left for some mainstream Democratic voters?
Again, this electorate went for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary. The thing about it is that this is not just about political position. People in Michigan have lived the consequences of government that has forgotten about them. So many people in 2008 lost their jobs. And we all know somebody who lost their health care because of that. So when I talk about universal health care and I talk about single payer, Medicare for all style health care, that is visceral for people. They understand what that means and what it would mean not to have had to go through that circumstance back in 2008. When we talk about a small business oriented economy, and I'm talking in rural places in Michigan, they know I'm not interested in selling out to the big corporations who've up and taken their jobs and offshored them or automated those jobs away. When I'm talking about rebuilding public schools as a son of Michigan who went to Michigan public schools, they know that I care that their kid's school is meeting the best requirements that we can set for it, empowering the people who care for their kids and their schools, their teachers, and making sure that the buildings are up to code. This is basic about what government ought to be, and yet we've allowed corporations and their profit margins to corrupt our politics, taking us away from what government was always supposed to be. And we're just saying we need to take it back to that core ideal, a government for people and by people that truly does speak to the ideal that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal. And if that's true, we've got a lot of work to do.
Shifting gears a bit, would you have done anything in this campaign differently?
I mean, there are a lot of things. Anybody who tells you that they did anything perfectly is failing to learn from their past. I'm somebody who always tries to learn from my past. I think there's a lot of things we'd have done differently. But I will tell you that the
such
core,
as what would you do differently?
I mean, I just think that that we'd have started a lot earlier in terms of the kind of outreach we wanted to do. Started our ground game a bit earlier. I think we would have maybe pivoted with news cycles in some different ways. But we've learned and we've become better because of the mistakes we made. And I think that is the mark of a true leader, is that you're always willing to ask what went well and what didn't go well and what could I have done better. And that's something that I always have made a habit of asking what didn't go well, how do I learn from that, and how do I make sure never to make the same mistake twice. And so I am thankful, though, that we have stayed true to our core and our message of a government about people, for people, by people, a government that that is not bought out by corporations, and being honest and forthright about bold solutions to challenges that we face, whether it's single-payer healthcare, whether it's 100% renewable energy, whether it's bringing down the rates on auto insurance. We have stayed true to our core, and I'm very proud of that.
Should you not win the nomination come August 7th, would you have any reservations endorsing either Gretchen Whitmer or Sri Tanadar?
If Gretchen Whitmer wins the nomination, I would gladly support her.
And Mr. Tanadar?
If Gretchen Whitmer wins the nomination, I would gladly support her. I think it's important to me that the winner of the Democratic primary is a Democrat. And I think there's very clear evidence that that Mr. Tanadar is an opportunist. And you know, whether it was giving a full contribution to an opponent of Barack Obama, whether it was voting for Rick Santorum, whether it's the fact that, that he giddily took a selfie with Marco Rubio, it speaks to me of a certain opportunism in the moment, and I don't believe in that in our politics.
Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
There is nothing better during a Michigan summer than spending time on the Great Lakes. A few weeks ago, we asked you just what questions you had about our state's freshwater seas, and we're going to bring you answers all summer long. We begin today with this question.
My name is Ted Benarski, and I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My question is, are there areas of the Lower Peninsula where the aquifer is filled with Lake Superior water so that someone pumping up from a well was getting water that was chemically traceable to Lake Superior?
To answer Ted's question, let's turn now to Michigan State University hydrologist Dr. David Hindman. Dr. Hindman, I think it's pretty safe to say we're aware the Great Lakes are the largest group of freshwater lakes on Earth by total area and the second largest by total volume. And so many of us get our drinking water from the Great Lakes. But where does all that water come from in the first place?
The vast majority of the water comes from the Gulf of Mexico. So that's the big source of moisture that goes up into the atmosphere and creates our precipitation that basically fills the Great Lakes.
That I think a lot of us didn't know. All right, Gulf of Mexico is salty. Why
it is.
Why is the Great Lakes fresh water?
Evaporation takes fresh water out of the oceans, and the salt is left behind in the oceans. So if you looked at the precipitation that's coming down, even on top of the oceans, it's fresh.
Okay, thank you for that. So how much does the water move around from lake to lake?
It moves a lot. So there's a fairly rapid flow between the lakes, from the headwater lakes to the lakes at the end of the Great Lakes system. And there's also significant groundwater flow. So precipitation falls on the land. Part of that becomes recharged to the groundwater system. And then that groundwater flows out to lakes and streams and back to the lakes.
How much kind of interaction are we seeing from the groundwater in the lake? Is that a lot? And is it from groundwater all over Michigan or more on the coastal areas?
It's all over. So most of the water that gets to the Great Lakes gets there via groundwater, because basically there's a very small amount that falls directly on surface water, and that flows down rivers and streams to the lakes. But the rest of the area that is land has water flowing via groundwater down into the lakes and streams, and also directly to the lakes.
Does climate change affect the water movement in the lakes and the water interaction between the lakes and groundwater?
It does. So climate change in areas like ours that have significant snow, it changes the cycle of that melting. So rather than us storing a snowpack that melts in the springtime, we find we're getting more intermittent melt now. And that can actually shift the cycle of the groundwater recharge and potentially make the streams lower flow in the dry portion of the year.
I remember how really, I think, exceedingly happy water scientists were with the winter of 2013-2014 when we set records with our snow and it lasted well into the spring. That really helped, didn't it?
It did. It recharged the lake significantly.
Now, does the water from each lake, Dr. Hindman, have its own chemical signature? I guess I'm wondering if I took water coming from a tap in Monroe, from a tap in Grayling, and from a tap in Grand Rapids, would you be able to figure out just where that water came from based on a chemical signature?
There are small differences in the chemistry. Most of it has to do with the human contaminants that we put into the lakes. So, for example, if you look at Lake Erie, it has higher concentrations of nutrients than Lake Huron, all the way up to Lake Superior, which is the cleanest of the lakes. So that's the biggest signature. But it's difficult to put an exact fingerprint on water because it changes on a seasonal basis and also on an annual basis.
What about groundwater?
So groundwater is fairly stable. So if you think about groundwater flow times in Michigan out to those surface water bodies, it can take anywhere from years to even over a century in some portions. So there's an interesting concept that we're working on called the land use legacy, where there's water that is coming out in streams right now that might have been from a pristine area. But now that land cover is actually agriculture, so there's more contributions of nutrients to it. So it's a very interesting concept when we talk about management of these water resources.
And kind of wondering what's awaiting future generations. If it's taking years or up to a century, what could happen down the road?
Exactly.
I guess that leads to kind of my final question. Why does it matter for us to really understand all of this?
Well, water is the most important resource on the planet. We all rely on it. And one thing that we find is we don't really pay attention to water quality until there's a problem, until there's contamination in the water, or if we run out of water, if our well goes dry or something like that. And I work a lot in arid regions of the country, the High Plains Aquifer, and there are areas of that aquifer right now that are being depleted. And that water resource is critical to supply really intensive agriculture that has high yields. So very important for us to think ahead about both the quantity and quality of water all across the world.
If you could wave a magic hydrologist wand and have things set up to the point where future generations would be assured of good fresh water, what things would you have happen?
I would have people really think about sustainable water supplies, and sustainable both in terms of quantity and quality. So what it would take would be the policymakers that are making the rules would have to work closely with scientists that could make predictions and projections of what's likely to happen to quantity and quality through time. And by working as a team, we could actually move forward and decide the best way to manage these precious resources.
Dr. David Hindman is a Michigan State University hydrologist. Thanks so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me on.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.